Welcome to episode 35 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand paper making and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Craig Anselowitz, an artist and designer affiliated with Awagami Paper Mill in Japan. I first met Craig over 25 years ago in New York City, when he was a paper buyer for Kate's Papery, and I was the program director at Dudonné Paper Mill. We talk about Craig's work in product development, which took him from Kate's Papery to ABC Carpet, and then to Thailand. While at Kate's, he met his wife, Aya Fujimori, who is in the eighth generation of a papermaking family and is in charge of the company's export sales. That's how she met Craig. Craig tells me how Yoichi Fujimori, Aya's father and president of Awagami, transformed the family business, which was once solely focused on traditional Japanese papermaking. He began in the 70s by traveling around the world to assess the needs of artists. He developed papers to meet their needs, invited artists to the mill to create unique works, brought students and artists to Japan in various capacities, and more. We also discuss how Craig has been instrumental in helping the company introduce Japanese papers and techniques to the rest of the world, largely through the help of social media. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Craig Anselowitz, welcome to Paper Talk. It's so good to see you after, I don't know, I left New York 22 years ago, and I think we both were working. I was working at Dudonné Paper Mill in the early 90s, and you were at Kate's Papery, and that's where we met. And I'm really excited to hear about what has transpired in your life.
Sure. I remember those days quite fondly, a lot of excitement, and yeah. Here we are, back to the future.
Yeah, that's right. So you are in Japan, and I'm in Colorado, and you're a day ahead of me. So tell me about your background, your childhood, and art-related, paper-related things that happened.
Sure. I grew up in New York, first in Riverdale, and then we moved out to the suburbs in New Jersey after my father's business succeeded. And I went to school and university for art and printmaking, started making paper through
Where
printmaking.
Where was that? Where'd you go to school?
First, I went to Delaware, University of Delaware, and then Fashion Institute in the city.
Okay.
And then I finished up at Penn State with my master's. And they actually had a full-on paper studio there. So. I was making paper for my prints as a means, you know, to save money for my printmaking editions.
Right. Teaching there?
At Penn State, Charles Cave.
Okay.
Who's since retired. And then, I graduated with my master's in 91 and moved back into New York. And then started working at Kate's Papery.
Okay, and what were you doing at Kate's Papery?
Originally, I was working in the paper sales when there was just the one store up on 13th Street. And as the company grew, I took over the entire paper division. So buying, developing, traveling, communicating, selling. It was still a family-run business, so people wore many hats.
Right. And is Kate still around in any variation?
Yeah, yes and no. The company was sold to a really lovely woman and her family. The intention for them was to get out of retail and to brand the Kate's Papery name with a series of products and then wholesale that. And to be honest, I don't know where it stands right now. But the name, the longer I guess we get away from the closing of the physical stores, I don't know how much the name still resonates, but at a time, the name was very valuable.
Right. Yeah, I remember discovering that store on 13th Street, I went to Japan in 1989, I think, and I became really intrigued with paper. I already had an interest, but I decided then and there that's what I was going to do. And I remember discovering Kate's Papery, and then the bigger shop down in Soho, which of course was near Dudonné, and that's where we got to know each other. So So what happened after Kate's then?
Yeah, so after Kate's, since I was doing a lot of product development for Kate's, including stationery and notebooks, as well as buying the complete paper range, that was a pretty wide assortment of papers, I developed a skill set for merchandising and buying. And then I moved on to ABC Carpet and Home, where I became a buyer for ABC. And then okay. I bought a wider range mm-hmm. of home decor and decorative products for that first floor. So that was also a bit of a dream job.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, but Kate's, was a great experience, and I met a lot of very interesting people, and it really paved the path for where I am now.
Right. So tell me about that. Mm-hmm. So how did the path continue?
Well, I met my wife at Kate's. So
right.
She came from Japan to sell us paper. Needless to say, I did buy some paper from her family mill. We stayed close friends and would see each other at trade fairs in Europe and Asia 2 or 3 times a year. And eventually I would move to Asia, to Thailand, and I would be a little closer, so we would see each other more often. And then eventually she moved from Japan to be with me in Thailand. There I was working for product design. Also some paper, stationery, and notebooks,
mm-hmm.
and designing other products and home decor. All the time still working in paper myself, making art and trying to keep my artwork going as I had my professional career. So there was always a love for paper. And then when I was living in Thailand and then my wife came to join me, we would be able to visit Japan quite regularly.
Right. And so your wife is Aya Fujimori?
Yes.
Or is that the correct? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so she is, tell me about the Fujimori line.
Yeah. So she is the 8th generation of working with her family paper business. She's not a paper maker per se. She's more in charge of export sales. Her father, Yoichi, is the president. He also is a master paper maker, but these days he's more involved in the running of the company itself.
And this is Awagami Mill Tokushima Prefecture?
Yes. So Awagami, Gami meaning paper, and Awa, A-W-A, is the original old name for that region of Tokushima. So okay. many things still carry on the Awa prefix. And so, Mr. Fujimori or Yoichi Fujimori, he's the 7th generation. And they've been making paper for 300 years or so. But Awagami as a brand is only relatively new, started in the 70s to kind of protect the business.
Uh-huh. And I know hand papermaking in Japan was really big, and then as with many crafts, the younger generations don't want to take them over. So can you tell me a little bit about how that, because Awagami seems to be thriving and have continued through this?
Well, it all comes down, there's a few things, but mm-hmm. being in the 70s, Mr. Fujimori traveled extensively through Europe and Asia and developed contacts with many creative people, as well as retailers and studios and artists, and started working with many important artists through Ken Tyler, through Gemini, and through other well-known studios. Doing so, he realized that in order to survive, there had to be some diversity in what he did,
mm-hmm.
and really had to address what artists and international creators were looking for. I would say since World War II, about 75 to 85% of washi mills have disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly coming down to not being able to adjust and adapt to current needs as Japan became more Western following World War II. And, those paper makers all had talent and skill, but they were unwilling to try new things,
mm-hmm.
or the next generation was unwilling to to diversify and look for new opportunities. And this is not synonymous with paper. This is with so many traditional crafts following the war.
Right. And so Mr. Fujimori he saw that need.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, he was the catalyst.
Yeah.
Because for, you know, six generations before, the mill was primarily making papers for interior shoji and fusuma, interior decoration papers, and calligraphy papers.
Mm-hmm.
And strictly 100% handmade, no machinery whatsoever. And yeah, Mr. Fujimori, he's college educated and has broad interests and traveled internationally and really saw how things were done internationally with paper mills in Italy and France and America, and really looked to them for ideas and how to assimilate and more or less keep one foot in the past and married to the tradition, but also be open-minded and look to the future for new opportunities.
Right. So what are some of those opportunities? And like in the early days, I guess, in the 70s.
Traveling and looking for artists who are interested in paper and collaborating with well-known artists. And learning from them. You know, in the 70s, there was a resurgence of hand paper making, as you know.
Yeah.
And there was a keen interest from younger artists and studios to develop paper art. Some of that can be seen in blue chip artists. Of course, there's David Hockney's Pools, and Robert Rauschenberg worked a lot with handmade paper. And there's quite a few others. You know better than me through your history with Doudanet. And Mr. Fujimori was at the forefront of that in terms of a Japanese mill willing to work with these people. And that really opened his eyes in the possibilities of what Western artists might need in terms of paper. They had a very different set of tools, a different aesthetic, different paints and pigments and inks. They weren't doing water-based woodblock printing. They were doing, you know, oil-based etchings. So how to make paper for these artists, but still maintain, you know, a Japanese washi quality.
Mm-hmm.
But make something that people really could use. So that was the early stages. And since then, just maybe within the last 10, 15 years, there's been the digital range of papers. So washi paper that has been made and hand-coded for inkjet printing and digital photography printing, you know, computer printing. This is a growing market. And also one that presented many challenges, because with digital printing, there's a whole set of parameters with ink quality and dot gain.
Sure.
That washi paper makers never really had to worry about.
So let's go back to just a brief how Japanese paper is made, and then maybe talk about some of the changes, like you're talking about. The things that he noticed that he would have to change to attract.
Sure. Japanese.
So you still make traditional Japanese paper.
Oh, sure.
And
sure.
So just the cycle of growing the fiber and all
yeah,
of that.
Yep. The mill itself is in a valley.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the mountainside, we have acreage with kozo growing. And some Mitsumata as well. Actually, we have a Mitsumata harvesting workshop coming up in 2 weeks at the mill.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so, and then we also purchase hemp and bamboo and gampi from farmers. Some is imported from Southeast Asia. Some is grown domestically, like gampi, you know, you have to buy domestically. It doesn't grow outside. So the process of kozo is still the primary fiber.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the workhorse. It gives you the benefit of strength, reliability, versatility, but also still beautiful. And we We make pure kozo. We mix it with different fibers to create different papers for different usages. But what's beautiful is these plants regenerate every year. So most of our kozo plants are multi-generations, 100 years old.
Right.
And they regenerate every year. When people come for our workshops, we like to drive them up to see. Mm-hmm. Next week, actually, tomorrow, we have a group of 25 students and professors from Rhode Island School of Design who will spend 9 days with us, and we will take them to the kozo fields, and they will have the opportunity to harvest the kozo with us. There's a long process from beating and cooking and steaming to sheet forming and final product, but needless to say, it's very labor intensive.
Right. And how many, how do you talk about how much kozo per year you process?
Oh, that's hard to
kilograms.
Say. ton. Well, in English, I guess we can say tonnage. Mm-hmm. So we can no longer produce enough kozo for the size of our business.
And wow.
We have a nice amount of land, but it's certainly not enough. So there are fewer and fewer people in Japan growing kozo. Mm-hmm. So back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, Mr. Fujimori purchased some, made a cooperative with some friends in Thailand to grow kozo. And now that kozo grows in Laos. In Thailand, they no longer grow kozo. So even if you buy kozo now that says Thai kozo, chances are it comes from Laos. That's about 20% of our kozo. The rest is from Japan. For our best papers, we only use Japanese kozo. So for the highest quality kozo, the pure handmade kozo papers for printmaking, conservation, or inkjet printing, those are our Japanese grown fibers. So it's a long process. We like to post photos and videos on our website or social media links to educate people. Mm-hmm. And we're always open to answering questions that people have about the contents of their paper, whether or not it has animal byproducts or if it's eco-friendly. These kinds of questions come up more and more.
And how did, I know the three main Japanese fibers, which you've mentioned, Gompi, Mitsumata, and Kozo, Kozo being the most common, I think. How did the hemp and bamboo come into the mix?
Well, that really goes back to what we were talking about, trying to find papers to meet Western demand. Mm-hmm. So the hemp fibers, of course, hemp is still illegally grown here. Cannot be grown here. It's illegal to grow. But it's ironic because the area from which we make paper in Tokushima was really one of the hemp capitals of Japan. Hemp was made illegal following the war. It was an edict from MacArthur and the American military. So hemp, it really became quite a sticking point. So we now import the hemp from Philippines to make a very strong decorative papers that are used for wrapping, primarily decorative use and interior design. So it adds a beautiful kind of coarse element that when mixed with traditional Japanese fibers, makes a really beautiful organic looking rough hewn kind of decorative sheet. And the bamboo was actually, my idea. So a few years ago, I was working on a project in Thailand designing a series of bamboo products and gifts to give out for a large corporation. And it turned out I ended up doing some bamboo clothing. And I really was interested, and I did more research, and I was like, we should try and use bamboo for paper making. I knew there was a history in China of making bamboo paper. When I did some experiments, I noticed that the bamboo fibers, they're very short and weak. So they don't make really good art paper. But Mr. Fujimori kind of took it from there, and I kind of asked him what his opinion was, and he started mixing it with kozo and other fibers, and he created the actual papers that we now make, which are mostly, 70% bamboo and 30% recycled kozo. So those papers now are really popular because they tend to be a bit thicker. So
printmaking or
printmaking, painting, and even letterpress.
Okay.
And digital printing as well.
Uh-huh. And what do you mean by recycled kozo?
So, of course, we make a lot of kozo papers, both hand and machine made, that just don't meet up to the standards.
Okay. Right.
So they're B grade, but the fiber is still good. So maybe the main sheet, the color was off, or there was some bark flex or something. It wasn't cleaned properly. So we recycle that. And this really harkens back to the kind of start of this discussion, was how to make something for the international market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though Japanese paper washi is thin and strong, there's still reluctance from Western artists because they're so used to thick, you know, 200, 250 grams. They go to printmaking school. You know, it's always about Arsh and Reeves, and, you know, these are the papers they get accustomed to. And no matter how much we try to convince them to use thinner papers because they have such a beautiful character and they are really beautifully expressive, they feel more comfortable with thicker papers. So bamboo kind of became a nice
In between.
Entree. Yeah. Into So it offers the best of both worlds. The bamboo is very soft and thick.
Uh-huh.
And then the kozo gives it the strength and the resilience. And the bamboo fiber is actually very reasonable, inexpensive.
Okay.
So compared to other Japanese fibers.
Uh-huh.
So the price of the sheet, you know, this was actually, I didn't even think about it, but this was a byproduct of after we started making and producing it. Oh, it's very, you know, cost-wise, it's very attractive, even to students. So it became an interesting.
Right. So tell me about the layout of the mill. Like, you have many things going on there, I think. Machine, and when did the machine make paper coming in? And
sure. There's a handmade paper section.
And how many people work there?
There's about 8 or 9 people are working there.
Uh-huh.
That's also like a working museum. So people can come on the floor and make paper alongside master paper makers. We have a setup for them. There's also indigo dyeing and a museum in that building. Across the street from there is the machine-made section, which was set up in the late 70s, early 80s, also upon Mr. Fujimori's travels overseas to expand the potential of washi. And he actually, so the paper-making machines there are fairly small in comparison to industrial machines you might see at a mill such as Fabriano or Hanamula or cranes. These are small boutique machines that are, I call them kind of Frankenstein machines because they're pieced together from other machines. And then we had to tool and engineer certain things to make these machines.
And do they make rolls of paper?
They make rolls. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And it's kind of like a Ford Rainier old school machine, which is part handmade, part machine. But nonetheless, whatever papers it's making, the fibers are all hand processed before even going into that machine. So it's not just
you
know, quick and easy process.
Right.
The machines also run very, very slow. So if you would ever watch a video of a giant paper mill machine, say Hanamula, or one of these large mills, they run very fast. These machines run super, super slow in comparison, about 5% the speed, 10% the speed, because the fibers are so long. Yeah, if the fibers are so long, so the machines must run slow. And it's quite poetic to watch. But so the machines are making rolls primarily of paper for student grade paper, paper for printing, like offset printing and packaging and interior use, still a big part of our business.
And then tell me about your export business.
So the export business is about, these days, it's about one-third of the business. Of course, the business in Japan has been, you know, it's 300 years, so there's a bit of a head start. The business for export really started in earnest in the mid-80s, mid to late 80s. Mm-hmm. So it's only a few years in comparison to Japan, but it's steadily growing. And we work with a number of distributors and retail outlets around the world. We work with about 50 different countries, and mostly for fine art, digital, and conservation papers.
Okay, yeah, and I've seen your displays. You have whole displays that you send to, like, stores in America, like Artists and Craftsmen, I think.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, that was part of my retail background, and is working at Kate's Papery for so long and trying to find ways of getting people to see and understand and touch the paper without being intimidated, and making it easy for stores to get in, let's say, the washi business, washi paper
right.
business.
Right. You
know, one of the particular kind of quirky things, which I find cool about washi, but it makes it difficult to merchandise, is all the sizes. You know, when you would buy Western paper, all right, you have 8.5, 11, and then for fine art, you usually have 22 by 30 inches
right.
or 70 by 100 centimeters. These were very, very standard. However, with washi, the papers came in so many different sizes, and those that made it difficult for people to have a kind of standard display.
Right.
And made it challenging for them to sell, too. Why are all these weird sizes, and they don't match up to our printer or our blocks or our press? And the interesting thing is those sizes were dictated by the original use of the paper. So even though artists are using them, well, the original use was for shoji screen.
Uh-huh.
And shoji screen has a standard size in every Japanese house.
Right.
Or they were used for a specific type of broadside or pamphlet. Or they were used, so whatever the application was, there was a standard packaging. The paper, that was the original size. So when it came over to the West, people were a little confused by all these sizes. So yeah, so we made a display for the art and the digital papers to kind of make it easy for people. And some people like it. Some people prefer, you know, to use their own display or keep the paper in storage in flat files. Or, you know, that's fine.
Right, right.
I mean, the idea, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
But, you know, my main focus when I came aboard to really help my wife and her family, as someone who came from retailing of paper and an artist who uses paper, was how can I make it easy for people to use washi and just to take the leap of faith. I had the experience myself for so many years as a printmaker and a student and as a retailer, and I really fell in love with paper, but I knew it was intimidating to a lot of people. So to this, I decided, you know, however I can make it easier for people just to touch and buy a sheet and so take the leap of faith, let's say. This has kind of been my focus.
And are people, is it successful, you think?
It's successful. The programs that you mentioned, the bamboo paper and the display system and some of the other things I've implemented online and in social media, sure, have been successful.
Yeah.
But there's a long, long way to go.
Sure, sure.
And there's many wonderful artists out there we want to work with, and we learn just as much from them as they do from us. It's really a symbiotic growth. And
oh yeah, I'm sure.
Going way back to when Mr. Fujimori started in, you know, working with these artists in the 70s.
Hey listeners, let's take a little break here, and I wanted to let you know about a new program over here at Helen Hebert Studio. I've started a free Facebook group called Club Paper. It's a place to share what you're working on, get encouragement when you need a little push, be inspired with new ideas, tips, tricks, books, and supplies, all having to do with paper. I hope to create a place over there where we feel like we're in a clubhouse, working on projects and having a conversation together. We're building a paper community, one sheet at a time. Join us by going to Facebook and searching for the group Club Paper. Now back to the episode.
So how what is that program, the artist? How do they get invited, or do they apply? And do you have a separate workspace for the artists? Do they work with master paper makers?
Yeah, that's a good question, because we have two different programs. Mm-hmm. We have an artist in residence, which is fully funded. Mm-hmm. There's three or four spaces every autumn, mm-hmm. and that's for 2 months. And that they can do whatever they want. They have to make a proposal. There's a call mm-hmm. for application, which will go out around springtime. Mm-hmm. And we post that on social media, and then it goes out through our mailing list. And then people apply for that. That's fully funded. We cover everything, airfare, housing.
Wow, yeah.
We have a house for them just across the street from the mill. And it's really a wonderful program. Then we have a visiting artists program, where people will send a proposal, and then we have kind of a list of costs and expenses. You know, pulp is this amount per kilo, mm-hmm. studio time is this amount, and still very reasonable. If you look at the costs and the opportunity to work with master paper makers, they will assist the artist. It's still very reasonable. And that is dependent on timing and, pretty much timing. Right. And how much and how many people we have coming. So we have someone coming from Finland next week. We tend to have one person there every month these days. We have English speaking staff who will help coordinate. So those programs are very interesting, and it's also interesting for our hand paper makers, who are, you know, they're making production sheets every day, and for them to see other artists, it also inspires them. So it's a very nice atmosphere when everyone's working on the floor together.
Yeah, and how do they settle on the project? Or, like, I can envision the artists who are coming, do they have any experience in paper? So they kind of know what they need?
Yeah, most
collaborative.
Do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, most do, or others are printmakers or photographers. Okay. So we also have a full printmaking and digital printing studios.
Okay.
So some of them come and do relief printmaking or digital printmaking or a combination thereof. And then others, they're pretty familiar with paper. If they have no familiarity and they're not quite sure of what they want to do, we most likely won't accept them.
Right.
Because but there's, you know, many people are quite focused, and we prepare everything in advance to make it smooth. So we'll ask them even for their palette in advance, mm-hmm. so we can prepare the pulp for them.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you can see on social media, on Facebook, there's some photo albums showing some of the past visiting artists and artists in residence's work. And it's really inspiring on a number of levels.
Yeah, the website has a lot of information, I think there's a story behind really large sheets that you make there.
Yeah, we make some really large sheets of handmade paper, upwards of 10 meters, 12 meters long, and those are made with a pouring method. Originally, we had a giant vat, and we were using a pulley system with multiple people around the giant vat and making huge sheets. This proved to be unprofitable, although it was interesting, and we learned a lot from it. So we developed another method whereby we pour pulp onto different molds on a floor. There's a rigging system and a vacuum system built into the floor, and we can make giant papers for printmaking, for painting. And these days we're working with some really impressive Chinese mm-hmm. master artists who are quite brilliant and want to work big. And Chinese, of course, paper was invented in China.
Right.
They inherently know and understand paper, but they can't really find mills that are open to working large and experimenting. And this is not only the case for these Chinese contemporary artists, but artists in general. I mean, if an artist goes to a paper mill and says, yeah, I have this really interesting idea to make these kind of semi-sculptural relief paperworks that are, you know, 13 by 22 feet and 96 colors, who's going to do it? It's really difficult to find a collaborative mill. And in Japan, with a language barrier, it's very difficult. So we like to be challenged within, you know, reason and timing, of course, is everything. But we accept the challenges to do unique works in paper. We will learn just as much from it as the artist as well. And that's always been, you know, Mr. Fujimori's philosophy. And, you know, we continue to this day to push ourselves and work with creative artists who really are interested in paper.
Right. Do you have, are you involved in tourism at all? Do mostly people just come there who know about paper and are?
We are involved in local tourism. We are very off the beaten path. So we're always very, very appreciative when people come to visit us because it's not easy to get to us.
Right.
It's a bit of a trek. And so when people do come, and almost every day now, we have people from overseas coming.
Wow.
Because they can make paper during the day. And any day, Tuesday through Sunday, we're closed on Monday, they can come and make paper. And they can also do indigo dyeing. And every day, we now have people. And that's thanks to social media, you know.
Wow.
We're so far out of the way, we have to use social media to reach people and let them know what's going on. And when people do make the journey and show up, you know, we're very thankful because we know they really want to be there.
Right.
We are in a very rural farming community, and it's kind of real Japan. Maybe that's not the way to say it, but it's a rural agricultural economy, so it's really quite beautiful.
Authentic, yeah.
Because, you know, even our family were farmers. You know, paper making was really a wintertime activity.
Mm-hmm.
And paper makers would harvest the fiber at the beginning of the winter. And during the winter, they would do paper making. And then go back to the fields for farming in the spring. And our family was no different. Mm-hmm. We were doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still where we are, a very rural, agricultural-based economy.
Right. And you have a 1 week or a 2 week workshop every year, right?
Yep. Every summer there's a 5-day intensive workshop. We have 20 spaces for paper making, book binding, and indigo dyeing. And it's really a nice way to meet other like-minded paper enthusiasts.
Yeah.
And we have, there's a local Japanese style inn they all stay at, and they have Japanese meals. There's an onsen for bathing, and they come as a group every day to the mill by van, 10 minutes away. And what's wonderful is that, you know, the group, they become close, and you can see on social media years later the connections and friends that are made. And it's really interesting. Every year we're surprised. Oh, this year there's someone from Russia and Slovenia and Australia. Of course, there's always, you know, some Americans and French. But these days we start to see people from Philippines and Thailand and Iceland and Indonesia and Singapore. And what's wonderful as well is that they also bring different skill sets. So there's bookbinders and conservators and origami artists. There's librarians. Right. There's Japanophiles. There's paper artists and printmakers. And it's really an interesting melting pot of paper people.
Yeah, that's amazing. Do any people come again?
Or is it Yeah, we actually, this last summer, we had two girls from Hong Kong who are paper conservators who came for their second time. Yeah. So the workshop is in August, so it's very hot and humid and sticky. Mm-hmm. And it's very intense. It's hard work because you will be beating fibers and cleaning fibers, and paper making itself is a very physical activity. So we warn people, you know, get ready.
Yeah.
You're going to get a bit of a workout.
Right. And tell me the website address just so people who are listening can look you up.
Sure. Awagami, AwaGami.com is the English website. And there's also links there for the Japanese site. The Japanese site is more fully developed, lots more information because it's been around for a lot longer. And the English site, we're just getting up and going within the last few months, actually.
Oh, wow.
And then social media, of course, Facebook and Instagram. We also, you can just search for Awagami.
Right.
So Facebook, we update almost every day, try and let people know what's going on at the mill, special projects or visiting artists or some other paper-related tidbit of news video.
Right. And what do you see the future holds? Like your wife, and is her sister, she has a twin sister, is she involved too?
There's three girls. And
is that the generation that is...
Uh-huh. Yes.
Coming up or taking over? Or,
yeah, there's also another generation of little ones.
Younger, okay.
Yeah, but yeah, and there's cousins as well. So actually the mill itself, we only have 40 to 45 people. It's and many of them are relations, cousins, extended family. And the future, well, we want to continue pushing. Things kind of, new directions in art and design kind of unveil themselves over time. Like this whole, we're still riding the wave of digital technology, and the digital printing and photography papers have been going very nicely, and we're pushing that. We continue to develop new things for digital output, but in a fine art, with a fine art twist, we're not interested in doing, you know, very commercial, cheap, inexpensive papers for reproduction. We're really trying to keep our niche in more the fine art market internationally. And so we will continue with that. And I think for me and my wife, we're also interested in publishing, being that we have the mill and we have a full printmaking studio and we have a digital lab. And we also can do book binding and other techniques. We might be interested in moving into fine art publishing, limited editions and things like that. Mm-hmm. All the tools are in place, and we have a lot of wonderful artists that we know and are interested in publishing with us, but we still have a bit of homework to do on that.
And so since you mentioned that, how are the artists that come in and make work there? Are you publishing any of that, or is it pretty much their galleries, or they're just taking their work and?
Yeah, for now, it's theirs. They own the work. We do ask them for a donation of one piece if they are so obliged to do so. But we're not publishing right now, so pretty much all the work is theirs.
So they're paying to come there and make the work, and then they take it. Yeah, that makes sense.
That's right. Okay. But as we develop, you know, our printmaking, we call it Awagami Print Labo, printmaking. As we continue to develop that, I think we need to put a master printer in place. We have a master printer for the digital printing, but for lithography and traditional printmaking arts, we don't have a master printer in place. So we're looking to find the right person who's willing to be our master printer in residence. And that will be kind of a key in moving towards publishing.
Sure. Cool. And
so if anyone's out there,
be
a master printer in Japan, you have to speak some Japanese, but we are actively looking.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Job opportunity alert. So just let's wrap up now, but I want to hear a little bit about your own artwork. I think you have a show up now, or you just had a show.
And... I just had a show in Kyoto of mixed media works on paper with Indigo. I kind of wear the hat of designer and artist at the same time. So I'm doing some interior, let's call them art panels of handmade paper and indigo, which are a little bit more decorative. And then I do my fine art, which is more autobiographical, using handmade paper and bits and bobs of my life in Asia and New York. And that show just came down. But even to this day, I still use washi paper. And I do enjoy mixing washi with other types of paper and mixed materials. And it's also educational when I mix these. Sometimes I stitch them on the sewing machine or bolt them or rivet very thick, you know, 1,200 gram papers to other materials. And but the aesthetic is very autobiographical. It's a very East meets West look. And I continue to try and work on my art. As an expression, but also as a way to experiment with washi paper. So,
We'll link to your website too.
Thank you.
We'll link to your website on the podcast page in the show notes. I just remember seeing video and photos of the indigo, which you just mentioned. You have a really, I don't know if it's a traditional system of doing that, dipping into the floor.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is that a traditional Japanese thing?
Describe
that a little bit.
Sure. Actually, indigo, the birthplace of indigo is in Tokushima, the Japanese indigo.
Oh.
So indigo is actually more well known than paper making from our region.
Okay.
Yeah. And so we started doing indigo paper a few generations ago. Mm-hmm. And we continue to do it to this day, where the indigo is in a vat. We have a vat that is in the floor, goes down about 9 feet to dip the papers into the indigo. And of course, indigo, for those who don't know, is a natural plant that is it's harvested and fermented, and it produces a brilliant, brilliant blue, or sometimes what used to be called Japan blue. And
you can dip just a plain sheet, but do you also do patterned?
Yeah, very much like shibori in textiles. Mm-hmm. There's different methodologies of crinkling and clipping and manipulating the paper before dipping into the indigo, and then opening, unfolding. You know, you can like it to shibori or tie-dyeing.
Right.
But what's beautiful is that indigo in itself ages beautifully over time. Mm-hmm. And it's still a living, much like washi paper is a living material. They also say indigo is a living color, and it will subtly change over years and years and years.
Right.
And there's been a renewed interest in it. We've seen a lot of our visiting artists and wanting to do something with the indigo. And recently I posted some images of an artist who did large scale digital photographs on washi. That were of landscapes that were then slowly dipped into the indigo to make a type of ombre, dark to light indigo wash on top of the photo. Really beautiful.
Wow, yeah. And does that vat, is it just continuous or does it get cleaned out? I'm just curious.
Sure. There's a shelf life. I mean, there's bacteria always in there.
Uh-huh.
So it smells almost like sulfur or rotting eggs. It doesn't smell really nice.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, sure. There's also a pH level that has to be maintained to get accurate color. And we make also semi-production, handmade paper indigo for artists.
Okay.
So there has to be a formula. The color has to be consistent. So the indigo pH level has to be measured regularly. It can go bad or rotten. So sure, there's a shelf life. And for our indigo, Mrs. Fujimori, my mother-in-law, is currently in charge and does most of the indigo dyeing. She has one or two assistants. It's still a very labor-intensive, slow process. So it tends to be a bit expensive, but absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, and is that a product that you sell internationally, indigo sheet?
Yeah, we sell on the website. There's mostly indigo stationery.
Okay.
Yeah, notebooks and postcards made from the indigo papers. The large full sheets we do sell in the Japanese site, but not on the English site currently, unless there's more and more interest we could start adding in the near future.
Right. And let's end up with like a product that's made. I think you've done some collaborations for wallets or I don't know. Are there some products that are made with origami paper?
Yeah, we. I think maybe the project you're speaking of is with Postal Co. P-O-S-T-A-L-C-O. They're an interesting company because they're also a New York Japanese husband and wife team based in Tokyo. They do really, really fine stationery and accessories. Uh-huh. And they came to us because they wanted to make a series of wallets and accessories that were waterproof and that they can cut and sew and stitch and rivet. So mm-hmm. we made some custom paper. The videos are on our website.
Okay.
And the paper came out really beautiful, limited edition.
Do you do the waterproofing or do they?
We do.
How do you do that?
Well, it depends. Yeah, it's not a secret. We often use konnyaku, which is a plant-based natural material, which has been used for generations in Japan for different things. So we use mostly konnyaku. However, we also make a line of beautiful wallpapers. Mm. They have to be coated in a different way to meet international standards. So konnyaku, although it's beautiful and organic, it doesn't meet international standard for fireproofing and so on and so forth. So we do use more of an industrial-made waterproofing for the wallpaper industry.
And the wallpapers, are they decorative or plain? And what size?
They're mostly plain with fiber, different kind of fibers. Uh-huh. Some have decorative kozo or rice straw.
Okay.
They tend to be very subtle. So they are sold 99% in Japan in sheets and rolls. But there is a future in exporting. It's just that those papers are very, very subtle and a little expensive. So we're trying to find the right partner overseas for the wallpapers.
So what do they go on to in Japan? What are the traditional the walls today?
Yeah, walls, doors, ceilings. Mostly for fine hotels, good restaurants. But they're beautiful for anyone who wants a really organic space because they imbue a certain warmth to them.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's really relaxing. So we've done some spas and yoga studios internationally, but not too many.
And what about installing? Putting the wallpaper up, it's just like anybody can put it up that is experienced in putting up wallpaper.
Yeah, because they're backed, we use a standard backing to make it easy for installation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we call it AWOL, A for origami, AWOL.
AWOL, that's good.
Yeah, if you're remodeling your home, let me know, I'll send you a roll.
Okay. Well, Craig Ancelowitz, it's been a pleasure having you on Paper Talk. Thank you so much.
And thanks for having me.
Yeah, everybody take a look at Awagami website and Craig's, and you'll find all the links in the show notes. All
Great
right.
Great seeing you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.